you, Jordan. I want to thank all our speakers today. We'll see whether or not I can answer this question just a little bit, and you certainly have all done your part in trying to address this. I say it is a question. I believe that it is true that water will be a driving force for sustainability in agriculture, but that will depend on some of the innovations that we've heard about today. The abstract's simply in there for general consumption when this is on the web. But I want to start off talking about this green revolution. Of course, the point that Terry made was that it was really a blue-green revolution. Irrigation was essential. We know that with more people, we need more food. I'm going to talk about water and the green revolution, what crop water productivity is very shortly, since Dr. Howell covered that so well. The U.S. story of increasing crop water productivity, which I think is a tale that needs telling and retelling. People are somewhat unaware of it, and the essentialness of irrigation. And some examples from the Middle East and Central Asia and the USA a little bit, although Susan O'Shaughnessy certainly covered a lot of what we're doing at Bushland in this regard, and then talk about some future trends and constraints. Of course, we're all showing this slide, or at least Terry and I are, but around the year 2000, we passed 6 billion people, and it's growing. So that we got there, we got to this part, sustained by the Green Revolution, and that's important. You know, we managed not to have what we thought, as was brought up earlier, the Malthusian prediction of tremendous population loss through starvation. It doesn't mean it won't happen in the future, but the world looks very different today than it looked like it might look in 1970. And the Green Revolution did things like create market price declines over that same period between 1950 and 2000 in all the major commodities, with a few bumps during the energy crisis in the 70s. Another energy crisis here caused some bumps in prices, but generally the decline is very dramatic, and that means that not only is there food, but people can afford to buy it. World nutrition improved during the Green Revolution. We went from 1964 to 66, where we had over half of the population of the Earth existing on less than 2,200 kilocalories a day, to now just 10%, and 10% of a much, much larger population. So this is a success story, and no one doubts that. But what caused the production growth that sustained this population and brought down food prices and made food more available? Well, irrigation figured heavily in both the yield components that we see, the blue, and in the cropping intensity components. I guess we can call that beige, between 1961 and 1999. And we know this because along with the Green Revolution, we had a Blue Revolution in irrigated land area around the world and within the United States, certainly, but in places like China, in India. We had a doubling of irrigated area during that time. That allowed the better crop varieties and the better fertility methods to actually be useful by supplying the water that allowed the plant growth to take place. But now we're in a situation where we can't just assume that water is there. And for a long, long time, we just assumed we could build more irrigation systems, we could put in more storage, we can solve problems by expanding irrigated area. And now we're in a situation in many parts of the world where water scarcity is real, and it is a critical factor in some areas like North Africa, in the Middle East, and in Southeast Asia. Now, there are other parts of the world where it is not. Latin America and the Caribbean East Asia, there's still a lot of water resource there. But when we start diverting our fresh water resource by more than 50% of the total, then we're really, really pushing our environment beyond sustainability, and that's what's occurring in some key areas. So greater crop water productivity is key to solving some of these problems. We need yield growth in resource-limited regions, but all of this depends on improvements in technology, both hard and soft technologies. The hard technologies of irrigation systems and control, and the soft technologies of better management. Well, Terry's covered this very well, so I'm not going to go very far with it, but I just want to mention that yield and water use, the two parts of crop water productivity, vary with crop species and variety, so there are a lot of soft choices there to be made. Environment, the soil, and the weather, so there are choices to be made about where to grow crops. Fertility and tillage management, which a lot of the Green Revolution was a fertility revolution. Irrigation scheduling and amount, irrigation method and management, and irrigation scheme and management of that scheme. So there are a lot of different levers that we can pull to increase crop water productivity. In the U.S., we saw some of these data in a different sort of slide, but in 2005, we actually passed 60 million irrigated acres in the U.S. You know, it doesn't stop. There was a period here. We had some energy problems right in here and a recession in the 80s that brought down some of that irrigation, and then it has increased steadily. Since we began keeping records, the amount of water applied has steadily decreased. Till 2002, it was less than 18 inches applied on average under irrigated systems. I saw somebody had a different amount there for that, but this is the one that I got out of ERS. So in the U.S. over this time period, agricultural production increased more than 100%, while cropped area actually decreased 18%. And this happened on the back of improved irrigation and expansion in irrigation. Part of what has happened in this country and is happening in other parts of the world is that irrigation is moving towards more humid areas. We've lost a lot of irrigation in California. The irrigated area in the Mid-South and the Delta region along the Mississippi is now on a par with the irrigated area in California. So this is our second California over here. Of course, there's been a lot of increase here in Nebraska. We heard about that earlier today. But there's also been significant increases in places like Georgia and South Carolina. Indiana and Illinois, Michigan, Minnesota, places in the Midwest. Why is irrigation moving into places that are traditionally rain-fed? Well, it's all about risk-taking. It's all about trying to reduce that crop failure that you might get once in 5 years. But not just crop failure, but reduction in yield. Bankers no longer want to take those risks, and it turns out to be profitable to require farmers to have irrigation systems. That's a large part of why this happened here in eastern Arkansas. Eastern Arkansas has greater than 50 inches per year of rainfall. You would think in that environment that you would never need to irrigate. But it is very risky. Soils there actually have, a lot of them have frangipans, and they have very shallow, maybe 20, 25 centimeter root systems before they're stopped by the frangipan. And therefore, there's not much water holding capacity in those soils, or not much rooting depth where the plants can take water out. And so they run out of water quickly when you get a week or 2 week long period without rain during, say, corn silking or whatever crop is being grown. And a lot of rice, of course, but also quite a bit of winter wheat, quite a lot of soybean, and similar crops. So this is being all driven towards the east. This has some rather large advantages. actual irrigation amounts decrease greatly when we push irrigation into more humid regions. So this is a good strategy any place where this is possible. And if we pay attention to the rest of the world, this is actually happening on a very large basis in Africa right now. Some of the richer countries in the world, Saudi Arabia, for instance, are purchasing or leasing, long-term leases, very large tracts of land in eastern Africa and putting center pivots on them. And they are displacing some native populations, but within the rules of the countries in which they're working. And a lot of these countries do get quite a lot of rainfall, but the irrigated systems are overcoming the yield declines due to weather variability. Now, in the U.S., and I think we heard this figure earlier, 62% of irrigation systems are now pressurized. I can tell you in 1950, we never would have thought that that could have happened. Everybody would have said, oh, that'll be way too expensive. But now it's 62%. Yeah, even 10 years ago, it was only 52%. So that revolution is happening very rapidly in this country, and I'll present you some evidence that it's also happening rapidly in other parts of the world. For instance, Jordan, 95% of the irrigated area there is irrigated with pressurized systems, mostly surface drip irrigation systems. This drastically reduces evaporative losses, and it certainly reduces conveyance losses and makes crop water productivity on a large scale much larger. We've got a reduced vapor pressure deficit in our more humid regions. We've got weather station networks coupled to irrigation scheduling systems that have rationalized and improved irrigation scheduling over large parts of the western and central U.S. And I know we have a lot of agricultural engineers, agronomists, and soil scientists working on systems to do that in the more humid and subhuman parts of the U.S. as well. And then the internet and wireless communication revolution, as Susan O'Shaughnessy told us, is really bringing forward this ability to manage very quickly irrigation systems that are pressurized. Okay, a lot of people criticize irrigation with the thought that this uses a lot of water. Irrigation does use a lot of water. But here's some proof, 138 cropping seasons of winter wheat in the high plains. It shows very clearly the dots here are the irrigated and the circles are the rain-fed or dry land, as we would say. And whether we scale it against grain yield or against seasonal evapotranspiration, water use efficiency is by and large doubled by using irrigation. And yields are increased a great deal too. But the fact is, in almost all scenarios, rational irrigation increases overall water use efficiency. It doesn't waste water, it saves water. Another thing to notice is that this slope, a negative slope, with seasonal evapotranspiration, again, 138 cropping seasons worth of data, is significantly negative. Now, this positive slope for the irrigated data is not significantly different from zero, but it still is a positive slope. And this, of course, this is a rather volatile statistic here, water use efficiency. It's one that bounces around a lot depending on interannual variations, disease, weather, especially with winter wheat, winter kill. So there's a lot of variability in those water use efficiency numbers, but I think it's important for us to realize that irrigation makes a positive return out of this. Some things about irrigation scheduling, these weather station networks, I'm going to go over that pretty quickly, but certainly some rather large ones like the Oklahoma Mesonet have come into being, the CIMIS system in California, AgriMet in Idaho and Oregon, and Washington State with the BLM. Irrigation scheduling improvements, the crop water use prediction improvements have been very substantial in the last 15 years or 15 to 20 years. And scheme and region-wide water demand prediction using satellite remote sensing and aircraft remote sensing has improved greatly and allowed districts to manage much better. We've had a paradigm shift in irrigation scheduling and control. We now deliver ET data directly to farmers, rather than requiring the farmer to put a program on his computer, download data from a weather station, run the computer program, and generate ETs. We now simply deliver that. We have weather station networks. We do all the calculations someplace on a computer and deliver data daily to farmers so that it becomes very simple and very easy for them to use. We have wireless user control of things like irrigation, drainage, whether we're going to turn that drainage gate up or down, whether we're going to control sub-irrigation with the drainage system, wireless control of pumps for reservoir refilling out of drainage systems for water reuse. This has become a big thing in eastern Arkansas. And smart water application controllers that have not only urban uses, where the big sales are for these, but also uses in agriculture. Now, an example from the Jordan Valley, irrigated area there is only 84,000 hectares, but it's extremely productive. 95% pressurized, mostly drip. Greater than 30% of the area is in plastic houses, where yields are typically doubled and water use is typically cut in half through humidity control. Irrigation scheduling there is improving. There's now a weather station network shared by Israel, Jordan, and the Palestinian Authority with 21 stations providing data daily. And we have a weighing lysimeter in the Jordan Valley to determine crop water use. Here's an example. Conditions are very diverse. But in Al-Mafraq, in the desert in northern Jordan, we have a fossil aquifer pumping out of that at 300 meters. And developing very high quality peach production with some of the most modern trellising methods I've ever seen and drip irrigation. Down in the Jordan Valley, we have a very productive environment. Using this very scarce water resource, you see the surface water resources and the groundwater resources in Jordan really are not a whole lot of water. It's million cubic meters per year. Agricultural water use is about 65% of that. Now, interestingly enough, the secondary treated wastewater in Jordan is about 80 million cubic meters per year. It's a significant resource for irrigation and one that they are studying very strongly to see if they can't use that as an irrigation resource. There's a schematic of weather stations. There's a lysimeter with sweet corn on it. And here's a significant finding. The FAO crop coefficients for sweet corn and tomato, we've got an onion crop we haven't analyzed yet, show that under the growing conditions and the planting geometries, the row spacings used in the Jordan Valley, crop coefficients are about half of what FAO would tell us. That means that if we'd simply relied on the FAO numbers, we'd be over-irrigating those crops, because these were high yielding crops, so they behaved the way we expected them to. How are we doing on time? Okay. Well, I'm going to go by this. There's been a lot of accomplishments within that program. We've also been working with the Uzbeks at these stations in Uzbekistan, which is a Central Asian country with a continental climate ranging from arid to semi-arid, working on their 3.3 million hectares of irrigated land, most of it surface irrigated, looking at drip and furrow, comparing those to see if there's really an advantage to move to drip. On the crops you see there, and measuring crop water use with a neutron probe, excuse me. Results for corn was that yield was increased for drip relative to yield for furrow irrigation. Not a whole lot, because both were high yielding, but we saved 30 to 43% of irrigation water compared with the furrow. We increased the crop water productivity by 78% compared with furrow irrigation. There are large irrigated areas of the world in which advanced irrigation application methods will increase crop water productivity significantly. There is a whole lot of room for growth. For cotton, pretty much the same sort of a story. Drip irrigation really improved production. Uzbekistan is one of the best cotton growing regions in the world. It was the cotton breadbasket, so to speak, of the Soviet Union. It's where almost all of the cotton was produced and is still a very strong cotton producer. They know how to do cotton there. We borrow varieties from them for our breeding programs. Yet, with drip irrigation, they can increase both yield and crop water use efficiency. They can nearly double crop water productivity. I want to talk just a little bit about water reuse for agriculture. There's big potential in this country for this, and there's a lot. There was a session yesterday talking about this. There's a lot of stuff going on in the background that people don't know about. If we look at our three big freshwater withdrawals in the country, thermoelectric is about 41%. Irrigation is down to 31% because of these efficiencies that we've seen in irrigated agriculture. Public supply is about 13%. Some of the thermoelectric withdrawal is recycled and can be recycled. Well, a lot of it is recycled. But the public supply can almost all be recycled. Some of that does go to urban irrigation, but there's a very large resource there that can be used. About 8% of that public supply is consumptive use, and the other 92% can be recycled and reused. I think we're running out of time here, and I want to go past this. I want to talk a little bit about Egypt. And Egypt has 55 billion cubic meters per year guaranteed Nile River flows by treaty with the countries south of Egypt. At 8 billion cubic meters per year, the treated wastewater of the cities of Egypt is a significant water resource for irrigation. And by the Egyptian code, this can't be used for vegetables, for instance, but it can be used for fruit crops and for biofuel crops and for woody species, for bioenergy or for fiber and wood. So there's a great deal of potential both there and in Egypt. And if we go to Israel and talk to our Israeli colleagues, there's already a tremendous reuse of treated wastewater in agriculture. I see we're out of time, so I'm just going to go down to that last thing, variable rate control that Susan O'Shaughnessy talked about. This is the next milestone for us as irrigation folks, is to begin looking at, can we take these landscapes, and there's a lot of them, you know, not in the Great Plains where we are, but in a lot of places in the world and within the U.S. That are quite variable. Start using prescriptions as to where we apply water and nutrients, and start responding to things. If we get a winter wheat kill or a wheat disease in this portion of the field and can detect it and turn that irrigation system off as we go across that spot, we can save a significant amount of water. So there's a lot that we can be done there. There are significant advances in agricultural water management that have occurred, but a lot remains to be done. Our constraints to improving crop water productivity exhibit technological, economic, and political aspects, and we heard about the political aspects today. It's not just better technology. It is more appropriate policy that will save water and stretch water and allow the greater productivity that we need in the future to occur. And recycled and reclaimed water availability may be somewhat limited, and knowledge for safe use is certainly not where we want it to be, but improving rapidly. But there's a lot that we can do there. So I'll leave that open for questions if there's any time. And remind the audience that we do have a question and answer period for all of the speakers. So if the speakers will be available for questions, we can handle questions for anyone. Thank you.
out of time for questions. So, but do we want to go ahead and start the question
yes.
and answer session? And
yep.
anyone have any questions?
Any or questions for any of the authors, Dr. McDowell?
Previous speakers?
I have a discussion point.
Yes.
Steve, you're discussing water reuse in agriculture. I think that's a very interesting topic. And I often, when I'm speaking to people from other parts of the world, say that in parts of the U.S., there's very little reuse within the agricultural sector because the water is being produced by the urban areas, and there's often this spatial disconnect between where the recycled water is being produced and the agricultural production itself. And Israel,
I think you're wrong.
Hmm?
I think you're wrong about that.
Well, it's certainly the case in Arizona. There's very little connection. There's one area in central Arizona that makes some significant use of recycled water.
That I certainly believe, yeah.
And even in Israel, I mean, it's a whole system that delivers mm-hmm. it to agriculture. So the point is the investment for it and so forth, you know, what are the opportunities, what are the barriers for that? Let's say in the United States, if agricultural areas are increasingly disjointed from the urban centers.
Actually, I think they're increasingly integrated because the urban areas are spreading out into the agricultural areas. But you know, we can look at that from both sides of that coin. But if we can bring water from Northern California to San Diego, then our opportunities within that water conveyance system to put recycled flows, especially tertiary treated water that we could drink, back into that are rather large. So I think we have great opportunities within one of the largest water systems I know of anywhere in the world. Would there be more engineering needed? Does public perception need to be overcome? Certainly those things are true, but one thing that becomes true if you attend some of the wastewater reuse sessions I've attended, is that a lot of this has already happened. Under the radar, people don't talk about it because they don't want to raise public fur over what's going on, yet it's happening. So I think the question or the perception that we have a lot of problems to overcome is certainly true, but it might be a little larger than it actually exists, because people are doing this all over the place. Yeah.
I guess I'd like to comment on that too. You say there is no reuse of urban wastewater in Arizona.
No, that's not what I said.
Okay.
I said there's limited reuse by agriculture in the urban areas.
Where does all of Phoenix's wastewater go?
Palo Verde Nuclear Power Plant. Some of it goes to agricultural users downstream and west, and some goes for turf irrigation. But a significant amount is going to nuclear power plant.
Okay. I don't see much leaving Arizona. It goes somewhere.
Oh, some of it's evaporated. Some of it's going discharged into rivers, you know, normally dry rivers. We have effluent-dominated streams. We have, this is a real issue. We had a cotton-growing area near the Tucson area that reused treated wastewater, effluent, for years at zero price. And then wastewater has become valuable for urban uses. So it goes back to my points about competition and what's available. And when the county wanted to start charging them for it, they said no, because they have very cheap groundwater rights,
mm-hmm.
very low cost, you know, preference power. And it's an economic issue.
Yep.
They have the alternative supply. So we had a case where it's actually decreased and not increased, and we have virtually no, probably zero reuse within the Tucson area where we used to have some for agriculture.
Well, if it's displacing water that would be used by the city's other freshwater sources that are then possibly available to agriculture, that might be a win-win situation. It depends on where the water is coming from. Things like horizontal transmissivity of aquifers becomes important. You know, if we recharge here, will we be able to take it out over there?
Those are
you know, in the southern Ogallala aquifer, the horizontal transmissivity is so small that recharge in one spot better be pumped out of that spot. We're not going to gain much there. But I think that's a really good question, and it's going to be a challenge. And it's only a piece of the opportunity and a piece of the problem that we need.
It's interesting that we're talking about this, and I'm just finished putting together a special issue for water management on wastewater use here. Mm-hmm. I was the managing editor for it. I wasn't the guest editor. There will be 11 papers coming up shortly in agriculture water management that looked at wastewater reuse in sequence, off the farm, through the treatment plant, back. And it should be out in another 6 months or so. The Europeans are in. Well,
oh, definitely. I spent a few months in Austria, out in the eastern Austrian plains, and it was amazing to me how much wastewater reuse there was. It's all over the place, and people don't talk about it, but it's certainly there. Yeah. Yes. Which returns?
Sorry?
What returns per unit of water?
Net returns.
Net returns, yeah.
Per unit of water.
Yeah.
So we have to see both not only the yields per mm-hmm. unit of water, but also how much money the farmer is getting per unit of water.
Farmers don't live in an economic vacuum, that's for sure. They have to be able to make money. Well, I would say one thing. Certainly in the U.S., we've got a very good track record of helping the farmers make money. So we think we can do that with improved technology and elsewhere as well. But that does sort of put the finger on policy. Fair policies that are applied to everyone may allow more expensive technologies to be used, where otherwise, without policy and regulation, they wouldn't be, because the marketplace wouldn't allow them to be used. You see that sort of thing all the time. And we're certainly seeing it. We heard about the metered wells in Nebraska. And we're coming to that in Texas. We've got some metered now. Now, the enforcement isn't like what you have. But I think that we will get there. And once people are really metered on their water use, then they move to more efficient systems. They have to. Bob, you look like you're just sitting there waiting to ask when lunch is. Terry.
As we move, we're deficit irrigation, like starters, business of rainfall. Your yield variability is going to be going up, and your risk goes up, and that means the business is going to be looking forward toward crop insurance and the risk agencies to back them up the way.
I think that's a point well taken. That is, as we go towards more deficit irrigation, we will be seeing risk go up. We will need stronger crop insurance programs. We'll certainly need to provide some sort of a net. But I also think we have technological approaches that will reduce that risk from what it might have been if we didn't have them. For instance, this crop-based sensing allows us to apply regulated deficit irrigation in a way that we maintain pretty darn high yields. and that's one technology. Soil water sensor-based technologies also can allow us to come closer to that edge in deficit irrigation, certainly pull back from what we might have called 100% full irrigation in the past, and achieve quite a lot of water savings, as Gary was talking about in his slide. Tom?
Policy can also moderate that, in that, for example, a lot of these regulated wells in Nebraska are regulated volumetrically over a five-year period.
Right.
That means even though your rainfall is variable, if you're smart enough in your technology, you can still reduce your risk to a predictable deficit level with a predictable yield.
And we're coming to that. At least one water conservation district in Texas is looking at a five-year horizon. You can only pump so much per year, but you could do 2 years in one and then have a fallow year or whatever. Yeah, there's a question back there.
Yeah, well, what are the roots in the park, the components of this decrease in irrigation and water use in California?
I didn't get that, Steve.
I say, well, what are the roots and the parts and the components of this large decrease in irrigation water use in this state?
In California?
California.
Recently?
Drought.
Essentially less water.
Well, there's been cutbacks to the Bay Delta. I mean, there are direct cutbacks to the water that can be delivered through the state water project because of the concerns about the fish.
Yep,
it
smelt
in the mid to late 90s,
and
it's accelerated since then.
Yeah.
Essentially regulating flow that can go through the Delta.
Jim.
And there's several sources to it. One is that we've had less rainfall and less water in the mountains, so there's been less water available. And there have been two rather major legal decisions, one on the pumping plant that feeds south towards Los Angeles that's been cut back severely by a judge because of the Delta smell problem. And I don't know whether we're resolving that issue at the moment. I think it's back in court again because one judge has said, let's examine whether the biological constraints that were used as the reason for shutting those pumps down actually had scientific facts behind it. The second decision dealt with Pine Kern, which is on the east side of the valley, feeds water down from about Modesto down to Bakersfield. There was a decision on the part of a judge there that said we shall have salmon runs back in the San Joaquin River, which dictated a certain amount of water release to that river at certain times of the year. And there's been agreements there. That judge ruled, and there's been adjustments on the contracts on the Prime Kern. So that, and then one comment I was going to make is that there are free markets in water these days, and the marginal value of water on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley went over $700 about 2 years ago per acre foot, and that was a farmer was able to get a loan and buy somebody else's water down slope to save his almond orchard. And we have free markets, but we have a water market system in the state of California that is only going to get more efficient and more robust with time as these water limits